But I'm not impressed by your performance.
Knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad.
We're not here just to take part. We're here to take over.
Hello and welcome along to chapter 23 of What's the Story podcast. My name is Danny Murray and we're back. The lads had a little week off, much to the disappointment of a lot of people.
Yeah,
some people celebrated, we won't talk about them. But
who celebrated?
Don't know.
I did, it was great not to have to see you guys for a while.
Yeah, it feels mutual, though.
This is brutal. As you can hear, they're both here, they're both present, they're both just... Lindsay's on the swinging chair again. It's going to be a long night. But Lindsay, Danger Doyle, how are you?
I'm great, Dan. Great.
Graham Merrow Merrigan.
Deadly, correct? Yeah, thank you.
And our guest this week is the founder, the CEO, was it? Of Suicide
That's
or Survive.
The rumours, yeah. That's the rumours.
We've been joined by Caroline from Suicide or Survive, and we'll be talking a good bit about mental health issues and all those kind of things. But before we do that, and before we delve straight into it, lads, it's been a while since I said it's time for a bit of housekeeping. Great, like, Merlo, myself and you, well, on separate nights, but we went to see you too.
Yeah, I went last Friday. It was deadly.
What do you make of it, yeah?
Love it. Yeah, it wasn't your average kind of gig, music gig, where you go to the point and watch a band. It was phenomenal.
A spectacle, extravaganza.
It was an absolute spectacle.
A feast for the senses.
He's a poet, this man.
He's a poet.
He's a wordsmith. Yeah. He's a wordsmith. Tell you, I'm impressed.
He'll just spit it out through all. You'll get used to it.
It gets cheesier, though.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. It starts well, but then it descends into talking bollocks pretty quickly.
There was, on stage, the normal stage at the Tree Arena, and then they had the runway, and then there was this huge... How do you even describe it, Danny?
This giant, interactive, mad screen.
It was a mad screen that, like, I was sitting over, if you're looking at the stage, I was on the right side, so I was just looking at this screen, and at some points throughout the gig, it was like a cinema screen where I was sitting.
It's hard to explain, because people who didn't see the show or haven't seen any of the photos or anything, this screen, it isn't just like a normal big screen. It ran... the entire width of the kind of standing section of the Tree Arena.
It was the whole standing section, and it would rise up and then it would rise down. But when it wasn't the screen, you could see through it, and the lads of U2 were sitting in it.
They actually
climb into the thing,
so you can see them through it, and then you can also see what's on the screen. So it's like they're interactive with what's on the screen.
Wow,
There's the song Cedarwood Road, where Bono and a couple of them were brought up, and obviously it's a song about that street, and the screen had the street like interactive cartoony, and then Bono got into this contraption and was just singing the song but walking down his street.
Yeah.
I was like, what the hell? This is mad.
It was brilliant. It was like, I've seen U2, like, I'm unashamedly a huge fan, like, and I've seen them multiple times.
You've seen them in Belfast on this tour as well, didn't
you? Yeah. And like, that screen is just, it's crazy. Like, even just Google it, lads. Just Google, because to try and comprehend this thing, like, it's just, like, you wouldn't have it in your sitting room or anything, like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not something that you'd just sort of watch the match on. Although, I'd say the match would be deadly on it.
Yeah.
You'd probably go up and score a goal yourself on it. Like, you know,
I'm not Bono's biggest fan, but I thought the gig was great. I was getting on great with Bono until, as I said to you.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the second last song, he decided to thank Dennis O'Brien, and then there was a few boos from the crowd, and I was just thinking...
Uncle Dennis.
You didn't have to, guys. He's the most hated man in Ireland at the moment, I think. Politically, possibly.
I can't stand U2, lads.
And then thanks Dennis O'Brien for giving him money for his AIDS charity, and then there was a couple of bills before he said thanking him for the AIDS charity, just when he brought his name
for
up.
His name.
Just forget about all the politics. Just play your gig and go.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of how I kind of feel about Bono as well. Like, I have a kind of love hate thing where it's like literally love the music, but on times I'm like,
just play your music. Even, I don't mind even on that screen they used a couple of from the Dublin Monaghan bombings. There were kind of there was a message like, open up the case. Nobody has been charged with this, and don't forget the victims. Like, those messages on the screens and stuff are excellent, but when he talks, thanks Dennis O'Brien, like...
Sure, half the time when you're at concerts and there's lads talking, you can't hear what they're saying.
But there was a great, the moment before he was thanking Dennis O'Brien, he was going on about freedom of speech and stuff like that, which is ironic because Dennis O'Brien has tried to shut up the whole of the media.
Waterford Whispers, come on the lads.
Yeah, the Waterford Whispers.
You just sweet Waterford Whispers. But one person who I think everybody was delighted to see up on that stage was Pandy Bliss.
Oh, he wasn't there that night?
Yeah, I know, I was. That's why I brought it up.
And what was it for the Mysterious Ways part, was it?
It was, yeah, Mysterious Ways and Desire. Now, he also had Imelda May up on stage at that point as well. Like,
I love Imelda May.
Yeah, but they do this bit where they give, they had been bringing people up out of the crowd, just randomers in prison, but on the night I was there, it was Panty. And they give her a phone, and that phone is broadcasting on Periscope Live. So people can, and this is on that big giant screen you're talking about. So it's this mad interactive thing. Like, it's
crazy.
But there's a great line.
You'd wonder how much the whole thing cost.
I'd say it was a pretty penny, all right. But there was a great bit where, like, Bono gave the microphone to Panty, and Panty was sort of talking about, you know, marriage equality and gay rights, and sort of saying, you know, this is definitely the biggest straight crowd I've ever played to. and she was kind of going on and saying things like that. And then this was a really nice moment as well, where she basically, like, thanked everybody, and the entire place just stood and applauded, and it was just a nice kind of moment, you know. We kind of got that warm feeling that, you know. And then, in fairness, Bono had a great line. He goes, "There you go, the Irish putting the gay into Gaelic," which I thought was a good line. Do you know what I mean?
Bono. So, he's a poet too, huh?
I thought it was a good line, lads. I was like, well played.
The Friday night, he just got a Canadian fan up to do all that, but it was deadly. Was Imelda May up during that section with Panty?
So what happened? He got Panty up first, and then after Mysterious Ways, he was basically saying, like, the Queen of Ireland, Panty Bliss, and everybody went mad, and he was like, "Panty, we stay on stage, but we want to bring on another girl who could give you a run for your money, Imelda May," and in the place went mental, and he done Desire, and it was great.
She's so down to earth and so real. I mean, she's just an amazing,
she's absolutely brilliant.
I think she's fantastic.
My granny loves her.
So do I.
But Doyler, on to you.
Good news about our podcast bringing people together that I've forgotten to tell you is actually, boys, we have Stephanie Roach, you know the way she was on, and she was saying she's doing more work with The Independent now.
Yeah.
Approached Ash Daly, having listened to our podcast with Ash Daly, and she's doing a bit now on women in sport, and she's going to head out to SBG, and Ash is going to train her a little bit, and they're going to do a
video.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. Stephanie then including that into our...
In the Indo.
She better say she got
get a plug.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be at the thing as well.
All right.
You just put a little warm in her ear. Do you know how all this came about?
Yeah.
Now my little podcast.
What's the story, Steph?
Great
That's
pony.
Deadly, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is actually. Brilliant. That is nice. Good. Yeah. Look at that. Bringing people together, lads.
Yeah.
And then the lads from Primal today messaged me, and they said there's some crowd got in touch with them that make YouTube videos and like mock things or whatever, and they want to come out and train MMA, and they want to do a thing about someone training MMA for the first time, and they want to do it out in Primal, and they want to spar a girl if they can while they're there. So the lads are like, "How do you feel about that, Lindsay?" And I was like, "That's a bit weird, but..." As long as we all go Royal Rumble on them if it goes wrong.
So what are you doing? You're sparring.
They're making a video. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know
who
the
are
details.
These people?
No idea.
So there you go. So it won't be long before Lindsay forgets about me and you. And she's off making big films.
She's not making big
films. You'd be going, "Graham who? Danny who?" Yeah. No, I never heard of
them. Oh, that was annoying too. I used to train the little moment.
Yeah.
Do you hear this?
Yeah.
See the goof we have to get.
Yeah.
Actually, Danny was in the other day, smashing a session yesterday, was it?
Yeah. I wouldn't say, I had 3 weeks off after a wedding. 3 weeks and I'm
Have you not been in the gym since the wedding?
No, I haven't. It's the best 3 weeks of my life.
What are we going to do?
I was too busy to chase him up as well, you know.
It's fine, because I knew. I took advantage of the fact she had her big fight. She had loads of other stuff on with other clients and working with Ash and all that kind of stuff. And there's me just going, "Guess I'll take a week off." And then a week became she's not here. I guess I'll have another week off. And then the other week, I was kind of like, well, now I'm actually up to my tonsils now. So I'm like, but it worked out great. So it did.
Until yesterday.
Wasn't as bad as I thought. I was suffering a little bit, but not as bad as I thought, to be honest. So I wasn't happy at all. So we were doing like leg pressers. And then we were doing these shoulder thingies back straight into the leg pressies. And we'd done a few of these back and forth in a couple of sets.
We'd done four sets.
And she turns around and she goes, we'll do prowlers now. What? Sorry? Sorry, you've just done everything. Why would we do prowlers now?
Why would we do more stuff?
You want to see the face on him.
I stopped mid-press. I was like, sorry, what did you just say to me?
Because I'd done the usual. Just time for a couple of prowlers now before we finish.
Thinking I wouldn't pick up on it. Like.
Carolyn's wondering what
I haven't a clue. I'm sitting here smiling going, Jesus Christ.
It's grand. The prowler's just up there. If you want to go up and start.
you know. Yeah, right. It's pretty much like
you show me, Danny.
Good one. Yeah. Don't get there for the rest of the podcast. We're just here panting.
God, all that. I'm looking around and I'm going, mother of God, how do people do it all? Well done, Danny.
Thanks.
Fair play. You came back. Well done. Yeah. I'd be gone.
I've dragged back for years.
Yeah, I'd be gone.
It's the benefit of having a gym / studio at our disposal.
Studio.
Studio.
Oh, I love it.
I literally the 3 weeks off I've had, I've been an absolute messer. Like, I've done nothing. I think even Cleo was suffered. She got walked maybe twice. So she's back to being a land walrus. The biggest, fattest Labrador you'll ever see in your life. Love that dog. So yeah, so now Lindsay will be back and
we're all back at it.
Yeah.
Fair play, Jess.
No. I've had four basketball matches, have two left. Then I'll be back.
Mayhem.
Yeah.
You look great with the new beard.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Yeah, green. You do.
His beard looks less like pubic hair and like facial hair.
I was waiting for that.
It was all itchy there last week and I trimmed it and then I trimmed too much so I had to keep going. I was a bit depressed.
You've lost about a stone from your beard. It looks yeah. I think you look great.
I say you're more aerodynamic. Have you scored more baskets or not?
I scored Saturday,
to go faster? Yeah.
We lost.
Is your face colder in the winter months now?
Cold. He's gone mad because he can't grow facial hair.
I can't. I get Amish beard.
Amish.
So it literally just grows around my chin and nowhere else. And
I love it.
I just look like a fat Amish person. Ridiculous. God. So this whole Movember thing, fair play to you lads. Look, if you're willing, if you're
guys in the gym done it, actually
brilliant. They absolutely
look,
brilliant.
I mean, I've no problem with people who are willing to look like a paedophile for a month, you know what?
Well, I was just going to say they all look like sex offenders. In the last week the coach over there had security outside.
Like some of the lads in work, I was like, you have to walk home by your crash rat because it'll cause trouble now.
Especially outside your job.
But now, yeah.
But now, look, they all look like Ron Jeremy's.
In fairness to them, look, it's for a good cause. Whatever charity they chose to do for, I think it's usually testicular cancer, is it?
It is.
Yeah, it's men's cancer one, is it?
Now they all look like 12 years old. Like they're all making their confirmation next week.
It's
they've
ridiculous.
All got the clean face now.
The difference in them. But now, look, I'm just jealous because if I wanted to do Movember 2016, I would have wanted to start in 2014. I just get nothing on the upper lip.
So start now and do 2017.
I'm not condoning it. Just donate money. I'm not into people looking like sex offenders.
It's easier just to throw a few bob in a bucket, isn't it?
Yeah.
Caroline has her head in her hands here. She doesn't know what to make of it.
What have I got myself
in the moment? I know.
Yeah. But, yeah, look, I just wanted to say I enjoyed my 3 weeks off. It was great. I only had, since the wedding, no ITEL, like last weekend I had a KFC after you two, which was glorious. But that's what I wanted to bring up. Sorry, I knew there was something I was forgetting. Lindsay went to Zaytoon for the first time.
Yeah, on Saturday night I was dragged there drunkenly.
Lindsay's always going on about healthy.
Right.
We're always talking. Have you heard of the spice bag, Caroline?
No. Oh, the spice bag.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. The lads at home love it. Yeah. I said the spice bar.
No. The spice bar, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that the guys eat that I've never had. And
she's never even heard of it. She never even heard of the spice bag.
Oh, even I've heard of them. I'm an L one.
Until the lads told me. But then they were talking about Zaytoon. And then I was out Saturday night drinking, which is very rare for me. And after I left the nightclub, my friends weren't getting food. And I made them mistake of saying I had never been to Zaytoon. It's like a kebab shop in town that everyone loves.
Yeah.
To say I was dragged across town to say too, and I kept on saying, can we not get a rickshaw? And they were like, no, it's just around the corner. And then I got there and there was 7 million people there. I was like, take a ticket and wait 20 yeah. minutes while drunken louts were just chatting away to me for this kebab that I didn't even want. We jumped in a taxi. I got home. I took one bite out of this, a chicken shish or something. I got.
Oh, delicious.
Chicken shish.
I was just like, this is the most disgusting thing I've ever tasted in my life. And
how,
that was it.
How very dare you, Lindsay? When that, the best thing about a kebab is when you bite into it and the sauce starts to drip out of it.
Yeah.
It's like the nectar of the gods just dripping onto you. Like.
And then I woke up the next morning and the taste in my mouth. I brushed my teeth about 6 times before I went to bed and I woke up with this garlic coating on my tongue.
Unbelievable.
I was like, what is this?
Gorgeous.
What you were describing there is, I dream about that now.
We go out and get it tomorrow then. Yeah,
now we just wake up with the taste of broccoli in my mouth. And all.
Broccoli and chicken.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
The funniest thing was, I text him that night. I was like, I'm in Zaytoven or whatever. And then the next day I wake up and they're like, what do you think? I was like, it was terrible. Danny, straight away, you take that back right now.
How very dare you?
How dare
you?
Get that taste of broccoli in your mouth.
Yeah, Sunday roast.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He was having KFC, the fucking messy.
It was, yeah. I had KFC after you too. It was amazing. Got a zinger tower. Unbelievable. You don't know what any of this is. It's a chicken Philip burger, right, with a hash brown and cheese.
Oh, shit.
Oh, that sounds disgusting.
How very dare all of you people.
There's something wrong with you.
I don't like KFC.
I'm going up to KFC in Carrick Mines to give them your photo and tell them under any circumstances you're not to be served.
No, I had me fill. That's it. I'm done now.
That's, you're I'm damn straight. You're done.
I'm going back. That was a tre.
Yeah, it was.
You was both saying it.
I seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. You was
both. Witness, Danny. Yeah.
What's more disgusting is that you like the KFC gravy.
How can you not like gravy?
I like gravy. Pissed out, though.
Right, we're gonna talk about food for 20 minutes, or we'll get Caroline in on the conversation.
I'm traumatized over here.
Before she leaves us, maybe we'll get some chats out of it.
This is why we shouldn't take a week off. It's descended into chaos because we haven't seen each other and we've all just been texting, and you can't get this manic mayhem across in a text. Although we did try with some brutal singing through WhatsApp.
Oh, God.
So, yeah. But anyway, that's all my housekeeping, lads. We've covered Zaytoven, we've covered you too, we've covered pretty much everything. You told us about people getting connected to each other. Graham trimmed his beard. All in all, lads, it's been a mad week, but I'm delighted to see us.
Yeah, samesies.
It's great to be back.
It is. It's great to be back. Caroline, I'm sorry you had to sit through that.
I think I'm doing well here, haven't I? No. Slightly traumatised, but otherwise I'm grand.
That's your usual podcast.
That's it, yeah.
That's good.
You wouldn't get this with Dale on News Talk anyway.
I remember our Saturday, I go to tell her. A very interesting experience during the week.
You'll be going, oh, Dale, thank God. It's so good to see you.
Save me.
Remind me to say no to everything else I'm asked to do.
Absolutely. So, as we've said, and that you might have heard glimpses of our in-between, me, Graham, Lindsay shouting over each other there. But I guess it is Caroline from Suicide or Survive. A local enough charity from the borough.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you'd have recognised her Ballybrack accent too, maybe. It's
extremely posh, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know.
She's one of the Ballybrackers that pronounce their consonants.
Oh, yeah.
What are they?
She's definitely from Ballybrack.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, it's lovely to be here, and thank you for the
thanks
invite.
For coming.
Thanks, Caroline.
It's great for having you in.
Pleasure.
So look, we'll kick off, I suppose. Tell us a little bit about Suicide or Survive and how it came to be.
Okay. Well, in my 20s, I would have...
6 years ago.
Yeah, I wish. I'm such a charm. I give him some money. Graham, I love you. But yeah, in my 20s, I would have, without knowing, actually, I would have... I would have went through, say, anxiety and panic attacks, and that would have sort of brought on depression. Now, that all sounds grand. I knew all of that. But at the time, it was absolute, had no words or language like I have there now. So it would have been started to have these weird thoughts. And I thought, Jesus, I'm not telling anybody those. And just like obsessive thoughts and thinking very negative and starting to get these rituals of, you know, something's going to happen and everybody's going to see it. And
sorry, what do you mean?
So be like, it's like I would sort of, what I didn't know was the anxiety and stress, which I didn't know, was starting to turn into my thoughts were starting to be sort of tell me that, oh, you know, there's something wrong here, but I didn't know what it was. And I'd start checking around me and going, what's happening, and it's like, Jesus, I'm telling, I'm not going to tell anybody that I'm starting to think that weird things are going to happen. And like, for example, my fear was that, which would be a very normal one now, that my bowels were going to release and I was going to lose control and everybody was going to see it. Now, that is a very common thought. Other people is, I can't swallow. And if, you know, they bring a bottle of water with them and it's like, I can't swallow. So what happens is your thinking takes over and it's like you start to think, Jesus, they're odd thoughts, which are not. They're just, everybody has mad and batty thoughts, but then you start to believe it and you start to sort of feed into the anxiety, and then that starts to turn into panic attacks. And if you've ever had an absolute horrible shitty experience, a panic attack, it's awful, because you just feel you're going to lose control and there's nothing you can do about it. So that was starting to build up in me, and I was starting to, and I remember one time going, if I sit down and say this to anyone, they lock me away, because John of God, so I was thinking they put me in, we'd say, put you in the Johnnyers, that's what we would have said.
And they probably would have.
Oh, they would have. Because I eventually did go to the psychiatric ward, but yeah, and that was my fear. And but the more was, if I tell anybody that I'm having these sensations or these thoughts or these feelings, and if you have a belief, you nearly think it's happened. You actually go, oh, that must have happened, and everybody's seen it. So it's really crazy stuff, but it's not. It's actually very normal for panic and anxiety. If you ask anyone who's gone through it, that it gets to that level, they, when they get past the embarrassment and when they get past the idea of that they're odd or that they're the only people who have gone through it, they go, oh, Jesus Christ, yeah, I've felt my legs are going to go. I felt I couldn't swallow. Other people feel they're having a heart attack. People feel that they're having they have a brain tumour. And you can say what you want to that person, but the anxiety's got so high that they just believe in that moment it's true. So that's where the panic and the anxiety, and I was working away, and then you live in a wonderful community where, you know, the only time you hear people struggling with their mental health was, oh yeah, they went to the big house, or yeah, they, I love that, what's that, they had a nervous breakdown. And you always expect someone to fall on the ground, you know, what's a nervous breakdown? And it's very hush-hushed. So I started getting caught in all of that, and I was becoming depressed as well. So I hadn't, no education, no understanding around it. So I went up to the local GP that had been our family doctor for many, many years.
How long did you wait until you said, right,
I waited a little while because I thought, you're weird and you're odd. And if you say this to anyone, they lock you away. Yeah, that was my first thought. I'm not feckin' telling anyone this, still think you're off your chaps. And then
And this was you in your mid-20s, was it?
Yeah, and then I started thinking, well, you are off your chaps. So I thought, and I didn't even tell my husband, John, for a while. I was like, nah.
So did you just let it, before you went to the doctor, did you just let it pass? These episodes pass?
I'd run out of situations, and I was feeding it. I didn't even know myself. I'd move out of the situation, and the rituals was then I couldn't have people standing behind me because I get this feeling and sensation, or if I felt locked in somewhere, I couldn't get out of a place again. That's very normal for people. I would, geez, I have to go to the doctor, or I must go down the road, and I'd have all these lovely white lies I'd start to tell people because I didn't know what was going on. It's fear. Underneath all of this anxiety, any type of anxiety, is fear. It's all about fear. But you don't know all that when you're in the midst of it. You just think you're off your chops. Oh, massively. And people, you ask, and we're here tonight, the amount of men and women that won't talk about panic attacks and won't talk about anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's like real, I don't know whether we see it as a weakness or if we see it as something we're ashamed of. But mental health anyhow gets bad press. And I always say to people, like, you know, 4.5 million people have mental health the same way they've dental health and they've physical health.
Yeah.
But we just give mental health bad press. So if you don't invest in your mental health, it is it's going to dip. It just makes sense, you know.
There's a stigma, I suppose.
It's still there, Danny.
And that's people, I suppose, half the thing, like the idea of us having this conversation, and I suppose we mentioned that you're on News Talk, and I suppose to normalise it, to get people talking
about it. It's ordinary, stuff I'm talking about, there'll be loads of people, anyone listening, you know, I have no doubt, and as I've worked for years as a therapist now, and I work in around suicide and mental health for years, right across the board, and like what I'm talking, people know this is ordinary experiences. But if you don't do anything about it, that's where it gets caught in you. And that's where if people aren't reaching out, it gets worse and worse and worse. And that's the danger.
Was your GP then, what were you met with?
Well, the GP, now you have to remember, I didn't know about personal responsibility or going into a GP, and I believed the GP was the expert, where now I understand that there is no experts in life. I'm the expert of myself, and people have expertise. So I went into the doctor and said, make me better, because I thought I was broken, which I wasn't. I thought I was sick, which I wasn't. And so done what everyone done straight away. Tablets. So I just didn't ask. I didn't know what Valiums and uppers and downers and sleepers and you know, Prozac and Lexapro and all those. I hadn't. But I just give me the tablets, make me better, and then let it all go away. So from the time I went to him, it was just three months. I went from no tablets to 16 a day.
Jesus Christ.
16 a day in a 3 month period, and that again would have been normal. I did not know that Valium were highly addictive. I didn't know sleeping tablets were highly addictive. Now, I wanted them all because I thought, what's going on in my head? I need that to stop, and I don't know how to stop it. And to me, it felt like madness, whatever, man. And now I'm delighted to have a touch of madness. Thank God, you know, we all have it. Listening to you earlier, I don't feel on my own. But at that time, I was terrified. So took the tablets, came home, I broke down, and I said to John, Jesus, you know, that I'm off my chops, because you shouldn't be thinking this way and going on this
way. You were married and all during
this time. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, you know, this is crazy stuff. So went on the tablets. And do you know what was really sad about it? On that amount of tablets, you think in your 20s, you will start to dribble. You will start to fall asleep. You will start to, like, I was in work one day and I got that confused. You're taking four. I think I took a sleeper during the day. I don't even know what I took. But it's a horrible... Now, I did need support a certain amount just for a short period of time because I'd gone chronic on it. But nobody needs 16 tablets a day. Nobody at all. So obviously I became hooked on prescribed medication. So that was the start of it. That was the start of just a crazy, crazy experience. So then I had to learn how to dodge people and dodge life and make excuses and pretend and hide it in some way. So that just takes over your life, and people wanting to ask you, not known, afraid to ask you. And some people, when they did ask you, they ran a shag a mile. I didn't know what to say to them. So I remember the first time I went up to the doctor and he said, would you go and see a psychiatrist? I said, will I'm yours? I said, only crazy people go and see psychiatrists. So two times after that, I thought, no, you're totally crazy. So I said, go see a psychiatrist, because I'm mad. And that's how I felt. So when I went in on a tour, I remember it was a Thursday, and my panic attacks were that bad, I couldn't sit in the waiting room. So my leg would be jigging and I'd be like, you know, moving around. So I had to stand outside the hospital, and my husband was inside and he had to call me when I had to go in and see the psychiatrist. Now, you're in your mid-20s. I was just heartbroken that my life had got to that stage. And it was a real... Jesus McGuigan, you've made an arse of your life. And that's how I would have felt. So went in and seen the psychiatrist, and he said, will you come in as an inpatient just for a little while? And I thought, what have I got to lose? Sure, you're off your chops. And I remember I was going in on the Sunday, and it's so pathetic and sad. And I said to my husband, do you wear pyjamas in there or do you wear clothes? I actually didn't know. And I had to ring the hospital on the Saturday and say, do we wear pyjamas all day or do we wear clothes? And they said, no, you can wear clothes and whatever. And I remember having to say to my family and all, and everyone's just looking. I said, I'm going into hospital. Like, normally...
Was this St. John of God's? Or?
No, I got Camillus's and Vincent's. Okay. Yeah, just on a bit. Another psychiatric ward. They're everywhere. So I remember going in, and I remember what my husband John said afterwards. We managed to survive each other. And he knew, he said, I knew the woman I married going in wouldn't be the woman, wouldn't be the same person coming out. And I wasn't, never again. But I only stayed in for a short period of time. But then I became a day patient for years. But a whole journey in itself. And I became you become institutionalized in yourself. Yeah. So I depended on the tablets, and then we used to share tablets and give each other a few more. And
patience in there.
Oh, Jesus, come here. We were brilliant. We were dreadful and brilliant at the same time. Yeah, that became the norm. It's just sort of, you went, you seen the psychiatrist for 8 minutes. It was like, get your prescription. No therapy offered at that stage.
For 8 minutes only?
Maximum 10, yeah, at the time, yeah. Yeah.
So safe enough to say then that you know the mental health system inside out?
I went down then and studied it, the medical model, yeah. Because I went through it, Lindsay, after all, and then sadly for me, about, I suppose, 2 years into it, it was just getting worse, and the rituals and the everything. Now, as I say, I wasn't offered therapy at the time. Yeah. I would have had my medication, and we'd have done some bits. Now, I met great people, because when you hit shit, rock bottom, shite, and you can't go anywhere else, people are real. And it's lovely. And it's like, we'd nothing else to lose, because we were losing everything else in our life. I had to give up my job. I went 5 days a week in as a day patient into the hospital, and it became my world. It became my life. So me mates, I learned everything and anything that you could, the tricks of the trade, and you become institutionalized as well and massively dependent on the drugs and the system. But I got worse and worse and worse. And I think the first time, and this is the ordinary, this is life, this is what it's about, and this is what I've learned, what God, over the last 15 years. But when it was getting worse and worse and worse, I remember sitting one day, and I had all these rituals and ways of getting into life and getting to the hospital and getting back, and I was always tired, and then
I was just going to say, it sounds exhausting,
drugs and all that type of stuff. I remember sitting one day going, God, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And that was it. That was just, and it's like, okay. And then another while later, it was the first, and I would have honestly said that I would have never ever believed this thought would have come into my head. Only happens to other people. And it came into my head, I thought, you'd be better off dead. And I went, holy shit. And I went, whoa, that was a bit, where in the name of Jesus did that come from? And then time went on a little bit, and I went, okay, do I want to live? No. Do I want to die? No. And I thought, okay, this is a place that, and I thought, I'm telling nobody this, because they lock me away, and I'm quite ashamed of those thoughts, and I feel, where would I go with them? And my husband, very open, very, very, you could talk to him, really sound bloke, but I couldn't even go to him. And sadly, then what started to happen was, because the anxiety and the rituals and the depression had kicked in more and more and more, the dependency on the medication, and no talk therapy at the time. So I wasn't clearing my system out in any way. So I remember the first time that the word suicide actually came into my head, and I got an awful fright, but then I didn't. Then I was like, okay, yeah, I don't want to live. I don't want to die. I just want to shut this down. And I don't know any other way. I've done the tablets. I've done the psychiatric service. I don't know any other way to stop these thoughts and to stop this like, it's like that type of depression is, it's just a terror, and it's a dread, and it's just like, oh Jesus, I have to get through another day, and then that takes all of this, and I have to lie to this person and lie to that. So that then became an option, and that's if I work with loads of people who are suicidal. And that's the bit where I wanted to say to someone, I'm going to kill myself, help me not to, but let me talk about it. And it just terrifies people. And a lot of people want to talk about it without people going into crisis and going, save them, sort them. Because I wanted to talk about it to stop me doing it. But I wouldn't. And I wouldn't talk about it in the service, because I was afraid they'd keep me in there. So what happened was, the night we had a barbecue in the house, and I had a few drinks, and my mates were there and all. And I actually said, I'm not waking up tomorrow to that. And John always said he always had a concern, but he didn't think it would be that night, you know. And that's the night I attempted suicide. And like I said, there's no class discrimination. There's no gender, there's no age. And there's nothing mad about me. There was nothing mad about me. I got caught in distress. I got caught in a crisis and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to bring myself through it. Now, as I say, many years down the road, I learned the hard way, and it was a horrendous experience. It was, you know, I died and they had to get my heart going again. My husband had to be there and, you know, look, we're doing our best and all. And that's really, really
tough,
heartbreaking and tough. And I'm extremely, extremely blessed. Now, when I woke, I was ambivalent. I was like, oh, you couldn't even do that, because you have to remember I'm caught in that really shithole in your brain. And it's a horrible, horrible place. But something did ignite in me. I thought, well, you're here for something. Now, I hadn't a clue and I was a mess. And my bowels had released. I was, and they said, go and have a bath. And I said, no, I wouldn't have a bath. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing on this earth, but I don't care how I look. And I remember looking in a mirror going, God, who am I? You know, who am I? Or what is this all about?
How did I get
to
this?
So that was, I was still caught in the system. I was still caught in everything. But a couple of things that did happen. I got offered talk therapy for the first time, which should have happened. Now, that's, we pushed for that big time. It's not everyone, doesn't rock everyone's boat. But for me, I got an opportunity to talk for the first time and work through stuff and understand.
Is talk therapy literally you go in and you talk to somebody about
what
you're
thinking? So you're one-on-one on a therapist?
Yeah, it's one-on-one. I mean, I got that much out of it. I became a therapist. That was okay. And basically, Danny, it's about going into a neutral place, the neutral zone where you're not judged, where you can say the most off-the-wall stuff and clear yourself. System out and start to learn, well, what are my triggers in life? What shit am I carrying that doesn't belong to me? What belief systems, you know, for years and years you might, I'm not good enough or I need to be and all that. And you start to realise, mother of Jesus, you're carrying all that in your head every day and in your heart. Sure, that has to have an impact on you. So for me, I found that therapy was a good therapist, someone that, and no real nonsense and stuff, just someone who just gets you as a human being and is willing to hear and help you work through your struggle, but challenge you as well. Like, it was put up to me as well that the only person that could turn all of this around was me. And when I heard that first, I didn't like that. I said, no, give me the drugs. And I was still cutting them.
So the talk therapy happened after your...
After I attempted suicide.
Just what you're telling us so far, like, I'm just getting the impression that you kind of deteriorated when you went into the hospital. Would that be right?
No, because it was a combination of things. It was getting more and more, and then the medication, the level of it and the whole lot, and not having an understanding, not being educated around mental health, not realising that.
So you're just given tablets and not told why you were given the tablets. Yeah.
Well, you'd be told you're depressed, you're anxious, you'd be given a label and stuff like that, but sure, that'd be like double dutch.
Perfect example of treating the symptom and not the
massively the symptom, I do agree that there is an element of when you get caught in panic and anxiety that you have to say, right, there's some things you need to undo, some of the rituals, but then you need to say, exactly, Lindsay, well, what created the symptoms? So how do I learn what in me has told myself certain stories that actually aren't true? You know, and it's as, and I don't mean to make it as simple as that, but it's like we tell ourselves our self-talk is lethal, absolutely lethal. So that was the start. So I remember I was sitting in a hospital, a local hospital, and three things that happened. One was the nurse that said,
"This is after the
after attempting suicide." One was the nurse said, "Like, you know, look at you. And look at all these other people trying to live. And there's you trying to die." And I thought, well, that has really helped. So that was the first judgment in the hospital setting.
Yeah.
But then
that it did help. It did.
No, it didn't. Because she basically said, look at you. You know what I mean? I was going like
kind of
that.
A suck it up type
I
thing.
I really thought, Jesus, I need that. And then I was down having a smoke. I smoked at the time. Smoked loads of cigarettes at the time. That's what you do in the services. But I remember the two lads were sitting there, and they'd got bits done, and they were, "How are you, love? How's it going?" I said, "Yeah, I'm grand." And at this, I was numb, and I was alive, and I was going okay, and I had the hair all out like this and all. And the two lads were there, and one was about 19, and one was in his 50s, and they'd got bits done inside. And I was like, "And what are you in for, love? What happened to you?" And I sort of tried to kill myself and it just went quiet and yeah. then whoosh, gone. And I thought, okay, so this is the stigma
yeah,
that
I'm is.
Going to walk back out in my life. So I thought, I have a choice now. I shut this down and tell no one, or I talk out.
Yeah.
Now, I was still a mess. I was still cotton. I had panic and anxiety and rituals and all that shite that stopped you going places.
Mm.
And I was still attached to the services. But I also knew, right, you're here for something.
There was something in you.
You're
that
here
was
for something.
Lucid
yeah, yeah,
enough to,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
to question even that.
Absolutely. And then after that, it's a whole story, building your life back up. Yeah. And what was lovely was that along the way, I got really pissed off. And that gave me lots of energy because I thought, why was a label put on me? Why were so many tablets put on me? Why wasn't I offered talk therapy? And out of that, I said, right, you need to study the system that you're in. You need to educate yourself. So I did. I started educating myself and saying, why does a GP put you on that much medication? What's the background of the medication? What's the pharmaceutical industry's background? And I just studied and studied and studied. I went into therapy, which isn't for the faint-hearted. It's I can understand why it takes a lot of courage for people to go in, because you gotta meet yourself and see some of the shit you don't want to see, because there's plenty in it that I created. So I had to go, right, how do you take responsibility for your life? Which took me a bit of time because I wanted to blame life and blame everybody, which doesn't help in the long run. But I then decided that I really, really got a lot from therapy. So I said, well, become a therapist. So amazing. I thought, if you're going to whinge about the system, the service, everything, what are you going to do about it? Like, get up off your arse, McGuigan, and do something.
That's amazing.
You know, like all, like what you is, what we're all doing. It's like, well, what am I going to do? Because, you know, in time, which I did, I had the kids. I said, like, do you want them to go through the same? Do you want them to feel that shame and that embarrassment around mental health? And I thought, no, feck this. And also, in time, do you want your neighbours to give their version? Or do you want to tell your kids the truth? And I thought, no, I want to tell my kids the truth. No, none of that shite, none of that hiding and embarrassing. So got to college. Don't know how I got into it, but I got into college. I left school at 16. Ask Graeme Starr. And I got into college and became a therapist. And then I studied the system and said, right, now loads of stuff had to happen for me to build my life back up again. And I was very naive. I went back to the health service and I said, I'm really, really excited. I said, of all this personal learning, and I said, I've got through anxiety, depression, which we'll all go back in and out in life, and I've survived suicide and I've survived your system and I've survived the prescribed medication, and I'd love us all to work together. Now, this is a good few years ago. And I then realised that the system, the power of the system, and I seen the psychiatrist looking at me going, ah, Jesus, God love her. And I knew there and then, I thought, wow, you're up against the machine. So that was the start of
Suicide or Survive.
Without me knowing, I sat at the kitchen table and I said, John, oh, I'm really pissed off now. I'm really pissed off now. And I sat and I said, what were the things I didn't get? And I actually was creating, it's called our Eden program, without realising it. Yeah. And then when the Eden program was created, there was three things I felt I didn't get, which we created. It's 10 years running now. And then out of that, Suicide or Survive and the other programs came about. But it was out of temper.
Yeah. did all that help you? I don't know even know if this is a proper phrase, but did it help you get better? Like,
yeah.
At what point were you better? Or
there isn't, yeah. No. And I think that's, no, fair play to you, Graeme. If you were to, mental health, right, and that's some, it's like if you think of a line, right, a ruler, and you have 0 and 100, right? So 0 is on well and 100 as well. And think of the physical end as well, right? We're all caught in going to be 100% and we have to stop that shite. Mental health is a continuum. So I get up in the morning, this is how I describe it. So I got up, we'll say youth today, for example, I fatigue at the moment, right? So that catches you, you know, the way it catches you and you're exhausted. So I got up this morning, and if we do from 0 to 100, I think it's the best way, and you don't need your masters for any of this stuff. So say I was at 40 or 50 today, that's my mental health, right? And that's good enough. So I've stopped looking for that 100%. For what? If you're at 40 or 40, but what mental health is, right, is that, what one thing could I do today to get me up to 42? And how do I keep an eye on, say, staying at 40 and don't go down to 35? So what's my triggers that bring me down to 35? So that could be certain people, certain situations, not eating properly, not doing all the stuff I know that works well. So say today I know I want to get from 40 to 42. That was it. And even if for the rest of the day I didn't get any further than that, that's good enough. Then I would say, do a little bit of, say, Qigong or something like that. I meditate. It rocks my boat. It brought me up to 45. It brought me up to 50. And that's it for the day. So getting better isn't anymore. I was always looking for, and then on this day, I will not have, I get anxious still. I get palpitations. I get panic attacks. I get a low mood. But who doesn't?
Yeah.
Yeah, among the four of us here. That's us being people. So what I've learned is, and as I say, I then went on and said, how do I get my head around all this? And also what I found in the system was everything's mystified, and it's like very, you know, you have to be such and such, which is horseshite. You know, that ruler is mental health in a nutshell. Now we can gloss that up and gloss it down. Yeah. But if people can learn, one, you're good enough. Two, you're on this earth for a reason and you are valuable. Your family need you, your community need you. I work in Wheatfield Prison with the prisoners. I work with prison officers. I work in the corporate world. I work in the community world, right across the board. And I have learned so much about the pressure we put on ourselves to fit in society, to be a certain way. And what a load of shite. I done it to myself. Do you know what I mean?
So it's absolutely spot on.
You know, and what I'm learning is that, you know, when I'm vulnerable, I don't like it. I don't like it, but vulnerability makes you beautiful.
Yeah. But you know that what you were saying there about, you know, I suppose what you're saying is what society, like what society says you're supposed to look like or supposed to, like, I had a good friend who committed suicide when I was 20.
Yeah,
and I always remember his poor father saying to me the day after it, he said, like, he was only he was 20, and his father was saying, he was the only child, and his father was kind of just saying, just looking for answers, and he was hugging me, and he was like, Graham, like, do you think he did it because he was losing his hair? You know, things like that is just, it's just like, so what if you're losing your hair?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, put a hat on or like, you know, I don't know if that's why he did it.
No, but, and the only person would be is him. You know, there's not one answer, and that's as a community.
But image would create an anxiety.
People have
said,
yeah, absolutely, Graham. Yeah, and it's about, you know, and it's really difficult because I'd often, and I work with families and people who are extremely suicidal. So, you know, I'd work right on the
brink.
Right on the front end of it. But, you know, there isn't one thing, and there isn't, especially if people are building their lives up, there's not a way or their way. It's going to be a combination of things. But the biggest thing we know, and I spent about five years working with Amnesty International. We took on mental health as a human rights issue and looked at the whole set of it and all. And what we do know is that this, if we break down the stigma. So you don't have to be fecking upbeat and positive all the time. You don't have to be, yahoo, life is great. Yes, it's great. And it's shite. Do you know what I mean? And it's allowing both of them to live together hand in hand. So I'd always say to people, I'm a CEO. That's what I do in SOS. I'm a founder. I'm a therapist. I've learned the psychiatric system. So I'm an advocate. I've taught from Maynooth University for years. And there's times I lie in my bed just totally going, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm just feeling shite. But I'm no less of a CEO and no less of a I can still do my job. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I'm no less of a man. I love Connor and Amy. Connor's 18 and Amy's 15. And we were in the middle of doing the Amnesty campaign, and I agreed to put my face, they done airbrushing, which was great, on a poster. And the poster had Caroline survived suicide, gossip left deeper scars. And I remember going, Jesus, now I better chat to the kids about this, and it's going out. And I decided from a young age that they'd know that their mammy had this experience, but I'm more than that. Same way we're all here, we're more. And Connor's coming home from school. He'd been about, Connor was about, let me think, about Amy would have been about 10. She's 15 now. And Connor, so he would have been about 12 or 13. So Connor's walking down Ballybrack from the village and all. And the lads are going, there's one of me on the bus station, you know. And the lads go, is that your ma, Connor? And he goes, yeah, that's me, ma. And all. So Connor came home and I said, how are you about that, son? Like, because I know what the message is on the poster. Jesus, ma's dead proud of you. Dead proud of you. And I said, fair play to you. Send Madzer comes in, Amy, and she's talking to her dad in the corner, and then she comes over and she says, Matt, you know the way my friends are really, really nice? And I said, I do, love. And she said, no, they're really, really nice. And I said, yes, love, I do. I said, well, I was in the yard today and they were all chatting. And I said, yeah. And she said, a couple of them came over to me and said, and I always remember what comes out of the mouth of babes, the little girls comes from the big girls, right? And they turned around and they said, do you know what, Amy? We'd be really, really embarrassed if our mammy tried to kill herself. And I just went, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, how do I handle this? So I said, Amy, how were you? Because I'm going, Jesus, 10 years of age in the yard and the girls coming over. And the girls have got this from the bigger girls. You
and
know?
What was on the message, Caroline?
It had Caroline survived suicide, gossip left deeper scars.
Oh, sorry, you did
yeah,
say that.
Yeah. No, yeah, grand. And I said to Amy, how were you, love? Which was more important to me. Ma, what would I be embarrassed about? She couldn't understand. She'd no concept and doesn't still, because she was brought up in a house that, yeah, your ma did attempt suicide, did have depression, was in a psychiatric ward, but she's also all this other stuff, and you know, that's life. But she couldn't understand what her friends were embarrassed about, because she doesn't hold any embarrassment about
mental health.
Very good.
Amazing.
So that's what we all can do.
That's
so
what
people
we need to aim for.
Well, people say, get the government to do this. No, and money alone isn't going to turn this around. It's no. Like when we all leave here tonight, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
How are we going to talk about mental health? Because we're the change makers. So I think, yes, the government, the school, the parents, the whole lot, but it's every one of us together. And yeah, it's like we're chatting here tonight about suicide, about mental health, depression and anxiety. Is there anything odd about that?
No.
Well,
I would see, like, I would have always seen mental health like your immune system, like it's up and down. It's not like
big time.
And yeah, I would be in here preaching to people about the importance of good nutrition for all aspects of your life.
Absolutely.
And exercise for health and well-being. But the lads often call me a hippie here because I just preach about being kind to yourself and stuff like
fantastic
that.
Fantastic.
That's what it all fits into, yeah, for me, is if your mental health and your physical health. I'm trying to turn the lads into a hippie.
You're a grey hippie.
But I know for me, it's like to try and, like, I remember I was from the age of 15, I was on the Irish kickboxing team. And
brilliant,
for 10-11 years of my life, that was all. I was so consumed about it. And then I decided to take a step back from kickboxing. And then I was like, why should I get out of bed today? I'm not training for
absolutely
a world championship.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I had to figure out who is Lindsay without kickboxing.
Brilliant.
And like, so that's when I started placing emphasis on mental health, because I was always very good at being physically healthy, you know, and then nutrition and stuff like that. But for me, it was always just, if I ever feel shit, like even on Sunday, I was out drinking on Saturday night and I don't usually drink. So I was a bit fearful on Sunday. So I come down here Sunday evening and done a bit of training, felt great then.
Yeah.
You know.
And you know, it's brilliant, Lindsay. You know, remember saying about the ruler? So you know, if you're at 20 or 30 or 40, there's certain things will bring you up,
yeah,
and then you have to watch. And it's not to go out on the lash either, but
a
price.
Well.
Yeah, there's a price with it. So
exactly,
you manage your own mental health. So you're taking responsibility. But you have the awareness and you have the information and education. And if we could just keep passing that out and saying to people, look, you're resilient. We're quite a strong nation. We've been through quite a bit. And if we keep reminding each other, exactly what you said, Lindsay, that you know what rocks your boat, you know. And it's just to say, invest in your mental health every day, the same way you brush your teeth every day, the same way your physical health. And I mean, yous are all into it. I'm walking once or twice a week, I think. And I'm preaching to everyone to do it. So, but it's that awareness. And a lot of people, you're in the depression before, you're in the anxiety and you're going, what happened? Where did, you know, you don't see the signs. And the other bit is that reach out to people, you know, it's really important. Everyone will go through shite in their life. Shite comes your way. It's how we handle it. And part of handling it is you might want to go to a therapist. You might want to go to your best mate. You might, but there's a block. There seems to be, particularly with lads.
Yeah.
Late teens and early 20 lads seem to be.
You mentioned there a couple of minutes ago, Caroline, that, you know, throwing money at the problem isn't necessarily the solution. And just what we've touched on there as well about, you know, kind of reaching out, talking to somebody. When you were first in the early days of Suicide to Survive, kind of who helped you out? Like, what got the ball rolling, or how did the ball get rolling in going from kind of you with your kitchen table to...
Well, me and John first, thank God for the credit union. We just kept pumping in and pumping in and pumping into it and building up. And I, you know, I was quite naive at the time, and I have very good relationships now at the HSE and the NOSP, the National Office of Suicide Prevention, sorry, and they've been funding us for the last couple of years. But in the beginning, nobody. I went heading off as feckin' green as green could shag and be, and I just thought, you know, I've now gone to Trinity, I got my arse into Trinity, I'm a therapist, and I was like, you know, educating Rita, delighted with myself and all that, and I love that film. And I thought, this is great, and I assumed that they were going to fund us, so every probable door that could be closed was closed on me. And then quite significant, it first was they're called Social Entrepreneur Ireland, and they see people as change makers. So if you're a business entrepreneur and your social entrepreneur is about, now I had to learn this, I was going, what's that mean? And they're people who see something in life and say, let's change it. So they sort of said, look, we're interested, and they gave me a few bob and said, look, give you a go and all. And then I went for an interview, and there was three men in the room, and I was yabbering away and telling them all about the project a year or two later. And they said, look, we'll support you a little bit more. And then one man in particular, his name is Dennis O'Brien, and he actually was quite taken by my commitment and my willingness, because I was going up against a system, and it's like a machine. And
how did you even get to...
Well, he would fund an awful lot of charities. He gives an awful lot of charities, and through Social Entrepreneur Ireland, I would have met him. And then I was interviewed by himself and others, and
they were dragons.
it was actually, but they were quite taken by just the ordinariness of, look, this is my experience. This is the program. I've gone and educated myself. I'm not just going on a random thing here. And when every other door was closed, Dennis continued to support me and his foundation, the Iris O'Brien Foundation. So what they've done over the last 8 years, which is phenomenal, and our doors, SOS's doors, would be closed. There's no doubt about it if he hadn't have funded. I got mentoring around, because you've got your heart bit, but you need the head bit, the business bit, to get the organisation, and to help me become a CEO and train up. So the foundation and the women in there are fantastic. I've been trained up, I've been mentored, I've learned, you know, how to strategically plan and manage and programmes and the whole lot. So that has been going on, helping us in the last 8 years build the organization up. And I remember one time saying, you know, why would you do this? You know, you don't have to fund me or take this all on. And one thing that he said, and it's the biggest gift you can give any other human being, he said, Caroline, I believe in you. As simple as that, I believe in you. So I've learned so much from a business perspective. I've still held the heart end of it, and the laughter and the madness, and I would not, Suicide or Survive would not be here today, only for him. And then over the time, as we built up, and we, all our programs are evaluated, they're evaluated by Trinity, so you can hear the service user's voice, because I'm big for the service user's voice, having not been listened to years ago. And so they're all evaluated. So, you know, we do now, we work with the National Office of Suicide Prevention and the HSE. We all work together. And I've always said, all the way through to everybody, And they know I don't mince me words. It's not about the old bullshit stuff. I've always said, it's not about, I don't want to fight witches, yeah. But I want us to work together for the greater good. So when someone comes, if it's not our organisation, we'll signpost them to whatever organisation. There is amazing organisations doing amazing work out there, but we have to work together. Yeah. And we there's, you know, if you don't signpost quickly,
yeah,
someone will fall through. Yeah. That's what we want.
That was something I wanted to ask, actually, because there are, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure each in their own right are all fantastic charities and they all do a huge amount for mental health and that, but is there a need or is there a desire amongst a group is to form kind of an umbrella organisation?
It actually happened about two years ago. 2 years ago, the National Office of Suicide Prevention and all of us said, right, let's start sitting down with our differences, get your ego and kick it out of the room and sit here. So what we've done is a lot of the organisations, it's a fabulous, anyone listening, there's a website now called yourmentalhealth.ie and it's attached to the campaign, The Little Things. So if you go onto that website, because we all work together now, you can put any county in Ireland in and we'll tell you all the services that are available. It'll tell you the times that they're open. It'll tell you if someone is in crisis, how to have that conversation. If a parent doesn't know how to manage the conversation with their you know, teenager, or if you if someone is bereaved, what happens, what do you do? For youth, there's brilliant organised, and that website is updated. It is, any of us that are on it, there's a criteria for us all to be on it, so that what we do is professional, it's ethical. So yourmentalhealth.ie is the website, and a lot of us were involved in the creation of that, so that all our voices were heard. So
that is brilliant. That's been a lot better than
years ago in terms of resources.
Oh, people have worked their arses off, and a lot of the times people will say, but there's nothing out there. It's just they don't know where to go. And also, we're not talking about mental health in the community, so it becomes the norm. Like, everybody knows where the gym is. You know, we have to say, we run wellness workshops. Let's let everybody know where the wellness workshops are.
See, and that's like the gym for your mind. You've had to change the word, haven't you, to wellness?
No, we keep suicide as well. I tell you why. Well, and that's really important, Graham. Years ago, I sat with family members and I said, for me at that moment, it was like suicide or survive. And that's what it feels like for people. And the word suicide gets pushed away. And I spoke to a lot of families who tragically lost their friends and, you know, children and brothers and sisters to suicide. They said, never lose the word. Keep the word suicide, because our families didn't do anything wrong. Yeah. You know what I mean? And we don't want them judged. So we've kept the name suicide. Or survive. And the amount of times on and off people are going, well, would you not, you know? And we say, no, we do have wellness workshops. And within the wellness workshops, it's like a gym for your mind. Highly recommend you go to them. They're all over the country. And we look at both end of the spectrum. So, you know, if someone hits a crisis, what did they learn from it? It's sort of what I learned from it. But also the general things of how your thoughts impact on your mood and all. Yeah. So it's really, really good. We keep the word suicide and we keep it for all of those people. Remember I said earlier about I wanted to talk about it to try and stop myself.
Yeah.
If we shut down that word suicide, we will shut those conversations down. We deliver the Eden program and people are suicidal. And they said what they really find brilliant. It's a hard old program, because we say, could you put the decision of death on hold and stay in this world for 6 months while we look at what would keep you safe when it comes along. And one of the things we get feedback, and we're about to run one now, if anybody's listening, in Mountjoy Square and in Galway and Mayo, we're expanding, which is wonderful. But they say it's lovely to go, this week I have thought of death, I have thought of suicide. And they said to be able to say that in a room where nobody gets terrified, where nobody rushes in and nobody judges them, they said it actually gets rid of it. It's a relief. So we hold the word.
It's interesting as well that you say that, because even when I was in college, I'd done journalism in college, and obviously you kind of look at what's going on or what's in the media, and then part of the assignments would be, okay, look, here's a story. We want you to do this now in this format. We want you to do this in this way and that. And even when it came to to summarize, it'd be either broadsheet style or tabloid style. That'd be the two. But even tabloid style, they'd be like, do not use the word suicide. Mm. Don't avoid it. Use you know, did they take their own life, or what was the circumstances with it? But avoid, and at the time, like, because I mean, I'm not, to be honest with you, it's only in the last, I would say, year and a half, 2 years that I've kind of started to read up more on mental health and all that kind of thing. But at the time, I was kind of like, why don't they say that word? Like, what is that? And then, you know, it's only when you start to read more about it, or you start to educate yourself a little bit more about it, that you see the stigma, or that you start to learn more about that stigma. And it's even now, if you pick up a paper or even on the news, it'll be rare that you'll actually hear the word suicide or read the word suicide in an article, because
an article, especially if it's a reporting of a celebrity who was taking their life.
And you see what happened was the media sensationalised. For that was the, it was like it's gone from one extreme to the other. The media were too graphic, and they were actually, you know, you'd see someone died who had schizophrenia or bipolar and all those labels that just, we don't buy into labels. People are people. But they were too graphic. And that was the problem, where the media was so told, look, educate yourself, inform yourself, and do it. I'd always say to people, I went to a big meeting, there was loads of media there, and they were saying, look, how do we do? And the media are up for learning as well. They said, how or what do we do? And I said, think if it was one of your family members, how you'd like to read that piece, that article in the paper, and that's how you treat it. That's what's really important. But the media had gone, they'd gone real extreme, and they were asked, look, we know from research that is of no benefit. All you're doing is you're scaremongering families, you know, and that doesn't work. And it's how you talk about it, it's how you bring it into conversations, and you need to do it in an educated and an informed way, because people are terrified, understandably so.
People are getting more educated, because it's maybe 5-6 years ago or whatever it was, when you heard of depression or depressed, you automatically thought suicidal.
Yeah.
How you've described it, with the kind of thermometer almost, the ruler.
The little ruler's deadly, isn't
it? The ruler, that's like an everyday thing.
Normal, it's that's not, mental
if
health.
If you're like depressed, you could be depressed for a day.
Or a morning. Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're suicidal.
Not at all, no.
You're just trying to, like, rehabilitate your mental health daily and just get on with the day.
Invest in it,
and then bring whatever makes you happy, kind of surround yourself on that all the time.
Learn about yourself,
Learn. And can I ask as well? Sorry, Daniel.
No, go on, go ahead.
Just when you were going through your kind of depressive time and anxiety and stuff like that, did your husband at all need any support? Or?
Well, that's interesting. It's one of program we're piloting next year is he has it's common sense. He's a very grounded man, and he was like myself. We were learning as we were going along. It's like, but he'd be grounded enough to sort of say, right, okay, let's check this out. Let's look at this, the whole lot. And when I was up in the hospital, I nearly said the hospital I was in after attempting suicide, I remember the nurses and the doctors and all came in, and it's talk about dignity, and I've done a lot of work around dignity with Amnesty and all around mental health, and I'm lying in the bed, right, looking like shite. So I'm lying in the bed, and the team walk in, and the psychiatrist stood at the top, and I mean, I've friends who are psychiatrists, and I've really good experiences, so this isn't me, you know, this is my own personal experience of a particular person. So the woman psychiatrist there, and I'd call them the baby psychiatrists, were around learning, and they're talking about me while I lie in a bed, and I'm going, okay, straight away, there's a bit of an imbalance here.
Yeah.
And I remember John, and it was more or less saying, sign her in. So he just took me out of the bed and brought me home. He said, no, that's it, enough is enough. So he was fairly, you know, he knew, but no, didn't. We didn't have family members, and that's really tough. Is often people say to me, Jesus, and that's where your mental health.ie is brilliant as well. It will help you if you need to have those conversations. It suggests from people's feedback how to talk to someone. Yeah. But like a lot of family members like that go, what if I say the wrong thing? What if I do the wrong thing? Or, you know, and for John at the time, no, there was nowhere you'd go, Graham, to find out. He was learning with me as we were going along.
Would he have taken it up if there was?
Practical ways. Oh, yeah, he'd be he's very, you know, right, okay, would that help? Well, then if that's going to help Caroline, let's do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, if there had to been, if someone had said, right, this is what people have gone through before, and this is the experience, and what we found from family members, this might help. He goes, Jesus, thanks very much. If it's going to help me wife, great. Yeah. But no, none of that was around, no. And it's only starting, we're only starting to now, by listening to people, and listen to people who've gone through it, you know what I mean? Mm. And listen to their family and say, what would help you? What could have helped you? And then educate each other.
Yeah.
Like one of my mentors works in the Irish College of GPs, and he'd say to me, now you're climbing a mountain, Caroline. I'm going, jeez, never climbed a mountain in my life. And he'd say, just imagine, he said that, you know, you're every so often you have to put your backpack down and you have to put your tent up and you just take a look out. But he said also you're planting a seed. I won't probably sit under that tree, and it might take the next generation to sit under that. We're planting the seeds of change around mental health, the four of us here tonight and everybody. But you're talking about a couple of hundred years of, you know, everybody psychiatric, madness, the house on the hill, nervous breakdown. We're carrying through our generations all this, and the word, and families have asked, people say committed suicide, right? And it was a crime at one stage. Now it's decriminalised, and families would ask that you say, died by suicide, you know, not committed, because they didn't commit a crime. Mm. Like even stuff like that, we're all learning, but we're only learning as we go along, and we can only learn by having these conversations.
Yeah. Mm. So. I think one of the things that helps as well, and I don't particularly buy into the whole celebrity factor on a lot of stuff, but I think the fact that you have people who would be a little bit in the limelight coming out and talking, like even Brezzy, for example, I wouldn't be a huge fan of Brezzy, but even he has a book, Me and My Mate Jeffrey, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And a friend of ours read it and gave it rave reviews. But, you know, you have things like that. You've got Stan Collymore, ex-footballer, very publicly coming out and talking about his
Paul Gascoigne.
As well. Ex-rugby players. You've got an awful lot of people now who are in a position.
Ashley Daly talks about it a lot.
Ashling Daly, UFC fighter and former guest on this podcast.
Mm.
You have an awful lot of people who are coming out and sort of saying, look, it's okay to be not okay.
Yeah.
You know, but if you feel the need to, don't bury it away. Talk to somebody. Yeah. And I suppose with Suicide to Survive, I mean, a lot of people mightn't even be aware in this area, in the border, that it's actually pretty close to their doorstep and the facilities are there to help them.
Yeah.
And it's a great asset.
And like, I think, Danny, what you said, and again, which is great, be involved around a lot of the research in Ireland, what is working, what isn't, what's internet. Scotland are pretty good, New Zealand, they're quite ahead of us. So the celeb end, absolutely, but also your everyday person.
Because
we need the combination, to connect with both. Because sometimes if it's the celeb, it's unreachable, and it can be, but for others it can be, if they can do it, I can do it. But I think what's really important is that we don't put out a message of, if you do that, that would be the way. You have to find your way. For some people, it is lying in bed and it is having a good cry. For others, it's going for a walk. For others, it's, you know, it's going to be completely different for everyone. So not to say, okay, get out and have your 5 apples and your 300 walks and this and that and all. And it's like, well, I just want to lie in my bed. Oh, no, you can't lie in your bed. Of course you can lie in your bed and have a good feckin' cry if you want. Just be mindful of, am I a little bit too long in the bed now? Is it helping or hindering me? Do I need to get up? And no, I don't want to do a shag and walk, but I'll stand out the back garden and get a bit of fresh air. So it's allowing, again, that realistic, if you're down in yourself, if you're struggling, that, you know, being upbeat and positive is so far down that end. But like what we're saying in the gym and all, you gradually build up and you turn around to your mates and say, look, will you have me back, or encourage me a little bit. I might tell you to feck off, but encourage me. So it's stuff like that is definitely good. And it is making a difference, but it's yourselves by what you are doing here. This is the stuff that turns it around.
I think people are always really grateful to help. Like if someone does reach out to you, I've had it before, and you're just like, I'm so grateful that this person felt that they could talk to me about
trust
this. And thank God, you know. And
big
then
time.
There's nobody, I can imagine, if someone was in that way and they reached out to them, that they wouldn't do everything they could to help them, you know.
And I think
it's like, it's people are just afraid to reach out.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly, yeah. And Graham.
To be honest, they should. Like Danny said, the motto of mental health is it is okay to be okay not to be okay, like
I think
it is. How do you stop someone from not being afraid to reach out, you know?
Well, if you think, right, here's real suicide or survive, right? What we don't do, we do not save lives. Do not save lives. We support and encourage people to save their own lives, right? So first and foremost, we need to get a very strong message out there, right? If you're going through shite, you're not, you don't need to be fixed. Nobody's broken. This is life. This is who we are, as I said earlier, as people. We don't save lives. That's a very paternalistic approach. It's basically saying, no one saved my life. I had to save my own life. Yeah. Now I got support and help along the way. But if you make me become dependent on others to save my life, I will never learn I'm resilient. I'm a resilient human being. Every one of us is resilient, and different things. As I say, I work in Wheatfield Prison a lot with the men, and I see that different type of resilience, you know, like how do you keep your mental health well in a community of 500 men in a prison, you know what I mean? And I learn more about myself in there than I do about the lads.
Can I ask you about the prison? Because yeah. I've just finished watching The Joy on TV3. Yeah. Like, that must be tough, I mean, to be assisting with the prisoners, because they seem to be, their mental health seems to go at an all-time low when they're incarcerated, but they're incarcerated for their actions. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
So how do you kind of facilitate them to...
I'll tell you how it came... Well, I'll tell you how it came about. I'll tell you, this is how we work in SOS, and tell me if this makes sense with the three of you. We have this motto, the student should surpass the teacher, right? So think of that for a minute, right? So about 3 or 4 years ago, the governor, they have a print room up in Wheatfield, and the men do, for charities, they'll do printing. So he said, would you just like to get some printing done? I said, God, thanks very much. And we got it done. And I said, geez, how we thank the lads, you know what I mean? And I said, not even thinking, we'll offer them a wellness workshop. You know, our wellness workshop takes about 40 people. Genuinely, lads, come on one, check it out. It's like educating yourself around mental health. Lo and behold, they said, yeah, come in and deliver a wellness workshop. I said, oh, holy Lord, I've never worked in a prison. Talk about my prejudice coming up, and I'm going, oh, help here. So that was 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And my biggest fear going into work with the men was, if I share my story, they'll think, Jesus, what's your one on about? I thought, I actually was concerned of what the men would make of my story. And I was blown out of the water. I was blown, and like what you said, Graham, the amount of men, and I'm no one's judge and jury, I always go, there go I, but for the grace of God, I have a son, a husband, uncles, and I, you know, people, lives come and people end up in prison and all, so I'm no one's judge and jury. But I remember when I went in and shared my story, and the chaplains are fantastic in there, and they were saying that, you know, one of the men came back and he said, she told my story of 30 years ago. And they were saying, because he didn't really talk much, he said, she told my story. He said, I had all that shit going on in my life. So you done drinking drugs. And then, and no excuse for whatever, nothing, no, absolutely not. But what I was very struck by was, like you said, Graham, the struggle of their mental health. So we're now, we've delivered in Wheatfield to 300 prisoners. And then that's our wellness workshop, a one-day workshop. And then we have another add-on then after that is our WRAP, Wellness Recovery Action Plan, which is 2.5 days. And again, this isn't about being suicidal. This is just around your mental health. So we delivered it. But what happened in the midst of all that is some of the men started to stand out. And we're going, they were innately reaching out to other people. They just reached out and supported the other men in the prison. And a lot of these are in for a long time. And we thought, well, I said, I haven't done time to date, so I don't know what it's like. Done the psychiatric service, but I haven't done the prison, thank God. And I said, they're the best placed, if they were trained up and skilled up, to work as mentors with the men and facilitate in time. The same way I have become to give, you know, to work around mental health. I used my own personal experience, but then got trained up because you have a responsibility. So 8 of the men we identified about just over a year ago, and we're training them up. So we're training them up that they will become the facilitators. And they, remember I was saying earlier, the student should surpass the teacher.
Yeah.
So they know what mental health is like in the prison. They know how it all works. So we're training them up and we're working together. And they will deliver the programs to the other men in the prison. Because well, to that me,
that's amazing.
It just makes sense, doesn't
you're
it?
Like, no. You're kind of giving them that responsibility as well.
Giving them the tools to use the experience that they
have. And the life experience, because I had my life experience and I had to fight to use mine and I had to push back to use mine. Now, we work with psychiatry, we work with HS, we work with everyone, but I had to keep fighting them. Now, it's still fight. It's still give a good old fight there if I found the old shite and nonsense going on. And it, to me, it was like, and all I kept saying to psychiatrists and different people, you know, and even psychology doctors and all, I'd say, let's train together, deliver together, and stop having, you know, these are the professionals and these aren't. And that's what the men are. So the men now, after Christmas, they've had a full year of training as mentors and they've done their rap and they've done all their programs, and they will start to mentor the other prisoners. And it's very well structured, and it's been the National Office of Suicide Prevention, the O'Brien Foundation and have funded us for it, and it's been evaluated by Trinity College, so it's all been done proper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But we do the same in the community. It's like, let's see,
well, it's its own community, isn't it? We feel
you could become rap facilitators one day, and I don't mean the rap and dance in there, lads. But you can do that.
I already have that one boxed off.
Rapping, Jesus Christ.
But that's how we work. So we don't save lives, we support and encourage people to save their own lives, and how you do that is
You give the tools to save lives.
Or we remind them that they already had them and that they're resilient, and let's build on them. Yeah.
So, that's amazing.
That's brilliant.
Like
it's common sense, though, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
But, Carolyn, we're running out of time, so I'd just like to say, look, thanks a million for sharing your story, because it's absolutely brilliant. And if it gets just one person who listens to this to kind of reevaluate something or to think of something, then that would be amazing in itself. But even if it makes people more aware, and if somebody approaches them somewhere down the line and says, I'm really struggling, and somewhere in their brain they think it is and they go, okay, then even that's an accomplishment. As well as from our point of view,
Karen, I'm in awe from you. Talking to you personally tonight. I think you're an inspiring woman, to be honest. That word inspiring can get shown, inspiration can get thrown around an awful lot. But I think the work you're doing is absolutely sensational.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Just want to ask you, there's someone listening and they are distraught, or they're in crisis in their head, What would you tell them, or
and thank you, and genuinely, it's such a privilege and a pleasure to be here, and I'm surrounded and I work with great people. I literally stand on the shoulders of giants, so all of this is with a whole team behind me, or with me I should say, alongside me. But what I would say to people straight away is that, this is from the bottom of my heart, life wouldn't be the same. We're here for a reason. It's really important to remember how valuable we all are. And that's just so important, because I now know, and I'm so glad that I didn't succeed. And it doesn't mean I have a great and wonderful life. You know, I have a blessed life. But I've shite like everybody. But anybody listening, straight away, if you go on to yourmentalhealth.ie, there's, for example, it's called One Life, and you'll get the number on it, and it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week helpline. It's a crisis line for people who are suicidal, and everybody on that are therapists. There's also the Samaritans, and the Samaritan signpost. So if you ring the Samaritan, same at One Life, and you talk through, because one thing I'd always say to people, if we go the extreme end of suicide, that if you're thinking or feeling suicidal, those thoughts will pass, those feelings will pass, but you're at risk while they're there. And you need a bit of a safety net just to keep you safe while they pass and get the support in place. And all those organisations signpost, but yourmentalhealth.ie is really good for what's in your community. Or if you've got a good friend, and it takes a lot of balls to reach out. So I'm not, you know, there's 10 people die a week by suicide. 8 are men at the moment. So there's a big message. Yeah. There's a big message there. Lads, help us out. You know, go on our website. We've got the Eden program. We do wellness work. We've wrapped. But we need yous to help us to tell men. I mean, what would you say to lads listening? Because yous are the ones that can
I'd love to help anybody. I would hope that anyone listening as well would be more, allow people to approach you or to be more approachable or whatever. Jesus, yeah, goes without saying, to be honest.
Yeah, 100%. If
I sometimes kind of, my friend who committed suicide when we were 20, I sometimes think, geez, what could I have done? I don't think I could have done anything at that time, but looking back, it's kind of going, Jesus, you know.
Yeah, I suppose from my point of view, again, a very limited experience in all of it, but I suppose the thing I'd say to anybody is, look, if you're going through hell, keep going. There'll always be somebody there who'll be willing to help, and if that means reaching out to a family member,
don't
or
ever be embarrassed.
Reach out to a friend, or look, I mean, on the long shot, that you think a stranger would be better, for lack of judgment, if you need to reach out to one of us even, and we can help you. Jesus, do. I mean, we're all over Twitter and social media, and you know, if you can get in touch with us anywhere, do. But geez, that's a frightening statistic that you've
given
there.
It is, isn't
it?
Yeah, and I'm always conscious. I don't use stats, because I think every person, that's someone's child, that's someone's brother and all. But like what you said there, Danny, which I challenged a little bit there, limited experience. No, you don't. You are the people. You have life experience as men. You know around mental health. So what you are saying is brilliant. That's what we need to hear. Exactly what the two of you have said there, and keep those conversations going. And like that, we don't all have the answers, but look, even if you got in touch, you can signpost people. You can ring our office, the girls up there, just at 1-890-577-577, and they'd be able to say, well, look, did you know about that service? Did you know about this? You know, and this is what we can do. So I think use lads, particularly around the lads, and obviously the women as well. I'm not taking away from that at all. What you're saying just there now is fantastic. And that's what makes the difference.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I suppose then, obviously, yourmentalhealth.ie being the main one. If people want to learn more about the workshops that Suicide or Survive run,
you go on to www.suicideorsurvive.ie, and one of the big things to say to everyone is that don't wait till something comes to your door. Go on to those websites, inform yourself, and then when someone comes, you can actually say, I'd often say to parents, just read that, and they go, oh Jesus, at least I could have the conversation and I didn't feel that I was saying all the wrong things. So whoever's listening, just do it anyhow. Get the information, have it there, that if at some stage in your life, and it will happen, someone will come going through a struggle and say, Jesus, did you know about such and such?
Yeah.
And then you're opening the door for them.
Absolutely. Well,
thanks very much, Caroline.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, lads.
We'll put all the information up on our website, and we'll link it everything with this episode that we put online. We'll link out all the links in and give the phone number and the details and that. But lads, look, don't be afraid to reach out, basically. That's the main thing from it. But so that's it for this chapter. If you want to follow more from us, all our previous chapters are there on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Podbean, Podcast Addict, anywhere and everywhere. Just search WTS Pod. We're at WTS Pod on Twitter, and we're What's the Story Podcast on Facebook. Doyle, or the people want to know more about eating broccoli and not eating Zinger Towers from KFC.
It's Lindsay Doyle PT.
I love broccoli
everywhere. I love broccoli too.
Hang on there.
I love it when the guests are on my side.
Hang on, do you like Brussels? Do you like Brussels sprouts?
I do. I love Brussels sprouts. I swear to Jesus, I love them.
Yeah. Can't be dealing with
that. Bit of butter.
Bit of butter and pancetta.
Butter
with a D.
Jesus.
Butter. Merlo, if people want to see your newly groomed beard,
I don't want to see it.
It's beautiful.
It's grand. Gorgeous. I'm sick of publicising my Twitter handles and whatever.
At Merigamania, at Ballybrack Bulls.
At Ballybrack Bulls. Follow Ballybrack Bulls.
At Grumpy Beard Trim.
Yeah, Beard Trim. I was going to get you a beard oil for Christmas. I don't need to anymore.
Have some at home.
And I'm at Dan John Murray. But look, lads, thanks for all the support. We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, Caroline, thanks again.
Thank
really
you.
Enjoyed that.
Thank
and you. Until next time, folks, good night. God bless.